Thank you for joining me for today's seminar on encouraging ethical encounters. Oftentimes when we talk about ethics, we talk about the problems that occur, the unhealthy relationships with clients, and the restrictions on people's license that can occur because of these types of behaviors. Today I'd like to teach you how to proactively look at situations ahead of time and use some of these ethical models that I'm going to teach up front in terms of decision making, in terms of seeing some potential problems in situations and then considering the consequences ahead of time rather than waiting until it's, quote, too late. I'd like to start by sharing a quote that I found really useful in the literature. Codes of ethics do not come to professions on stone tablets from high mountains. Rather, they're always a work in progress. They are developed by committees, examined by professionals and the public they serve, and then lived out by frail humans and adapted to changing contexts. So keep in mind that as we're looking at deciding if something's ethical or unethical, that we're looking at the context in which it occurs. We're looking at what other people, other professionals would do in a similar situation. We're looking at a number of variables that there has to be some basis for deciding whether the behavior is ethical or unethical. There are clearly things, obviously, that we would see as unethical, like having sex or having a dual relationship with the client. But oftentimes, where the decisions get kind of muddy is when we're not sure if a situation could be ethical or unethical. So that's where we have to look at what do we know already? What would similar professionals do? What's the context that I'm in? And what would the board say about this specific situation? I like to start in terms of defining the different disciplines. Now, I'm coming at a point of view today of what would the counselor, the State of Ohio Counselor, Social Worker, and Marriage and Family Therapist Board say. When we're talking about the different disciplines, we know that in reality, a lot of what we do tends to overlap between those disciplines. But there also is some distinction. When we're talking about professional counseling, for example, we're talking about individuals, groups, and organizations that work towards the goal of clinical counseling methods or procedures involving the diagnosis and treatment of mental health disorders. Now, these definitions are coming straight from what the board is saying each profession does in terms of their scope of practice. They say that social work has to do with application of the theory of social work, human development, restoring people to their capacity for social functioning, and use of psychosocial interventions. And finally, marriage and family therapy has to do with treatment of mental and emotional issues with more of a focus on systems. So we see some overlap, but we also see some distinctions. One of the limitations of ethical codes is that they tend to be profession bound, whereas we know that practice oftentimes is not. When we're looking at ethical codes, we don't always understand why the board made the decisions that it made to make some of the changes that it did. So sometimes it's hard for us to make better decisions in the future in terms of why is this change made. Ethical codes also can never be comprehensive because we do have so many different situations that are occurring. We work in different situations. For example, giving a client a hug in a grief type of organization like hospice doesn't necessarily mean the same thing as giving a client a hug in a mental hospital or in a private practice setting. Giving a client a hug in a private room versus a pat on the back or a side hug in a lobby or a public area is also somewhat different. So we need to consider the setting. We need to consider the mission of the company and what others would do in a similar situation. One of the other limitations of ethics codes is that there's challenges enforcing them. Ethical codes tend to be reactive rather than proactive. That's why I want to try and use more of a proactive approach today in terms of helping us look at how do we make these decisions? How do we anticipate possible ethics issues ahead of time before it's too late? One of the other things that can be a concern is the difference between what we call personal versus field ethics. Sometimes you might have a sense of what you believe is right or wrong or okay to do in life versus what is part of an ethical code. And there are some differences. There may be certain types of clients, for example, that you don't feel as comfortable with or may not really be in your scope of practice versus what does the ethical code say in terms of being careful not to discriminate against certain clients. Ethical codes also must be adapted to various cultural and other contexts. There may be certain things, especially when we talk in terms of diagnosis, that may be important to consider in the context that they occur. For example, there's been people that it's been questionable whether or not they were psychotic per se because of their behavior in light of their cultural background. I remember someone saying he felt like his family was against him. And there was a debate within one of the organizations in town about whether or not he was really paranoid. His family did have keys and access to his house. They did believe in curses and blessings from their culture. And so there were certain cultural considerations that needed to be taken into mind. Some situations aren't always easily handled by ethical codes also, so that's something to think of. There's a couple different ways that we can approach ethical codes and ethical rules. One is we can judge things on the basis of what we can foresee, not just our behavior if it's, quote, right or wrong, but what are the outcomes of possible behavior. What might happen if I, quote, get too friendly with a client? What might happen if I try to have a dual relationship? What might happen if I do some behaviors that most other people in the field wouldn't do? Another way we can look at things is what we call moral institutionalism. That consequences of behavior are important, but we do have certain duties, like to tell the truth, to do good and not do harm, to have a sense of justice, and making sure our clients have equal access to resources. One of the authors that is frequently cited in terms of ethics is the group Corey and Callanan. I remember as far back as when I was in graduate school that we looked at their books and their resources. And based on some of the resources, I've come up with some key questions that they use in terms of proactive decision making. First of all, we have to make sure we are accurately defining what the problem or dilemma is. What is the issue at stake? Is this an ethical, legal, or moral issue? And keep in mind there is a distinction. Now there can be overlap, but we have to look at those distinctions. For example, if I, as a therapist, am dressing too provocatively around a client, or I'm too friendly with them, that could become an ethical boundary issue, especially if that person's hurting. They may want to get too close to me in an unhealthy way, or I may even be giving a wrong vibe to them. It might not be illegal to dress the way I'm dressing, but it certainly can be unethical. So looking at the problem or dilemma, is it ethical, legal, or moral? Secondly, they suggest that we look at, who does this affect? Keep in mind that there's a lot of different levels things may affect people on. Of course, number one, we're looking at, what is the potential effect on a client? One of the things that may sound like common sense but is worth saying is to keep in mind at all times that that client, whether it be an individual, a family, a couple, a group, or a system, is coming in to us because of some presenting concerns. There is some woundedness that we're dealing with. There's some skill building that may need to occur. So they're coming in feeling less than whole, feeling broken. So they're already at a disadvantage in a sense. So that's where our ethical decision making needs to come in. I remember one case I was involved in. The gentleman did a one-time assessment on a woman. Hadn't seen her for years and happened to run into her in public and was what the board would consider overly friendly with her and too personal with her, to the point that the woman felt like he rejected her. And the thing that needed to be considered with that case was that even a one-time assessment and referral, even in a crisis agency, constitutes a clinical relationship. We must keep in perspective that our clients coming to us from a point of a presenting concern and of some woundedness. So even if it's years later, and even if it's a brief encounter or more of a pleasant social encounter out in public that we happen to run into them, this person, this client, always has seen us in the context of some presenting concern. This woman in this example, who was the person that had been assessed in the past, perceived things from the point of view of her presenting concern. Like I said, even though it was a one-time assessment, she had some trauma, she had some character issues, she had some things that were triggered. So we have to keep that in mind about who is the person we're dealing with and who is it affecting. So, like I said, most of all, it's affecting potentially the client. We also have to look at the agency or the group we're involved with. Is it reflecting their mission? Is it reflecting the job description of what we're supposed to be doing? Or could it be a threat to that? Then thirdly, we look at what ethical guidelines fit the situation. I encourage you, if you haven't lately, go through and really read the whole ethical set of guidelines there. I recently downloaded those and looked at those and read all of them, even the ones that didn't pertain to my LPCC license. It's very important that we're aware of what those guidelines are, not just for ourselves, but for colleagues that are also involved in this board. I might be an LPCC, but it's good to know what are the guidelines for a social worker or a marriage and family therapist. We are held responsible for making sure that we know this. The board will say that it's not up to them to let us know every single little difference and every update in terms of ethics, that we're supposed to be going on their website, we're supposed to be reading the different emails and updates that come out about what they're meeting with, what they're deciding, what things have been changed. And we're supposed to be aware of what these ethical guidelines are. Then, fourth, according to Corey and Callanan, we can look at what our colleagues think. So what would be called the reasonable standard of practice? This is one of the biggest ways that the board decides whether a behavior is ethical or unethical. So given a similar situation and a similar setting, what would most colleagues do with regards to this situation? We can also look at what possible consequences of the action can be taken and what are consequences of various decisions. Then ultimately, what appears to be the best course of action? One of the things I'd like to say, and I may say throughout today's seminar, is if you have any sense of feeling off about a situation, any sense of hesitancy at all, it may be important to pause. It may be important to go and look up the ethical guidelines. It may be important to talk with other colleagues in a similar setting or dealing with a similar type of client to really find out what a general standard of practice would be regarding the situation that you're concerned about. I can say, in having actually counseled people who had allegations against them for unethical conduct, that in the situations, the one thing that was unanimous is that each person at one point in the storyline of their dealing with their client had some sense of hesitancy. And they didn't always listen to that. They had a sense of things being off. So I'd encourage you, if that ever happens to you, to really pause and look at that. Another type of ethical decision-making model that you can consider as we go through today's scenario is the problem-solving model. Just like you would solve any other problem in life, you can go through these steps: identifying the problem, defining the goals. It's important to look at having a really good, solid treatment plan, a very specific, concrete, measurable, and behavioral treatment plan. So if a client's coming in, what skills do we expect to teach them? What is the frequency of the desired new behavior? What does treatment look like? Then generate possible courses of action. Consider beforehand the possible consequences of each action and look at the whole situation. So we're looking at precedents. We're looking at what other people might do. We're looking at if we're causing good or harm. In general, in the literature, they talk about preventative ethical guidelines. And at first glance, a lot of these may sound very common sense. They might sound like, well, of course I do this. But as I go through these, you really may want to look at some of your more difficult clients and really, really pull back and be honest with yourself about, to what degree do you really do these? So, for example, every session, welcome the client with kindness, empathic understanding, and genuine care and concern. So what vibe are you giving the client? I know we talk about Rogers process variables, and those are important for every type of client. But are we really communicating those? Or are our nonverbals, or even some of our attitudes, communicating with some of our clients that maybe we're wanting to get through their session rather quickly? Are we really communicating genuine caring and what's called true empathy? Have we cultivated trust in the clinical relationship? Again, we're talking about the boundaries of a therapeutic relationship. Have we communicated the ethical and professional standards and the expected parts of what the client's responsibility is and what our responsibility as a professional is? That's where it's good to have a very well spelled out set of policies and procedures. So something like showing up on time for expected appointments might be one set of standards that's in there. Professional dress, boundaries, confidentiality, and the limitations. Then comment on behaviors of concern in a timely manner. When you have that sense of something being off or a red flag, do you actually bring it up? Do you take that opportunity to reiterate with the client what the ethical boundary is, what the policy of your agency is? Do you quickly consult with colleagues? I remember when I felt rather uneasy in the past counseling a gentleman who had some antisocial personality characteristics, and he had made some bizarre comments in the session that caused me a great deal of concern about being around him alone or with minimal people in the office. So I was quick to talk to my other colleagues that shared office space with me and to reschedule him to times where more people were around and were more visible, so he knew what those boundaries were. We also need to call attention to the client in the situation by asking him or her to tell us the story regarding any areas of their presenting concern that we find unusual or we don't understand. We need to cultivate the sense of their entire personhood. What's the context that their presenting concerns are in? What's the setting? We need to frame things in terms of making productive decisions about clinical issues. We need to be balanced in our optimism and in our pessimism about how likely that we are to be able to address a certain issue. It's important, and we may not always do this, but it's important to make sure that up front, when we're talking about diagnosis and treatment of mental health disorders, that we share realistically with the client the positives, the possible strengths of adapting certain characteristics and certain theories that we may teach them, but also some limitations they may face. This is something I know a lot of people don't do off the bat, but that is something that's encouraged in terms of ethics. We also need to be ready to self-evaluate. Even if you're independently licensed, do you have other clinicians and colleagues that you can check in with, that you go to, that you can look at in terms of standards of practice? We need to be ready to personalize treatment goals and the therapeutic plan for each individual client. Like I said earlier, the context, the presenting concerns of the client, cultural variables, the mission of your company, all those things play into it. We need to focus on where the client's coming to us from. What is their ability to develop life skills? We may think a certain course of action is best, but has the client demonstrated that he or she is able to learn those skills, or that they've ever been able to demonstrate that before? What's realistic? What's a expected baseline? We also, as much as we're able, need to maintain the voluntary nature of counseling. That counseling is a cooperative venture between the therapist and the person or people being treated. That it's a partnership. As I said earlier, that there are responsibilities that the therapist has and there's responsibilities that the clients have. We need to demonstrate in words and behaviors that appropriate expression of client feelings will be met with empathy, understanding, and potential for behavior change. Now, when we talk about values, I know this can be up for debate, but this also falls in the area of self-evaluation. We need to make sure that we have colleagues that we're checking in with so that we're aware of the extent to which our values may be unnecessarily impacting a client. If there's clashes between our values and the beliefs or values of the client, we need to be able to address whether or not a referral might be in order. We also need to be careful to not further facilitate helplessness in people that are already vulnerable. This basically touches on the issue of client dependency. We're in a therapeutic relationship, but we don't want to do for the client what he or she can do for themselves. As we're teaching them skills in the counseling sessions, I like to give, for example, homework. Homework assignment helps the person who's vulnerable, the person with the presenting concern, practice things outside of session and learn that there's going to be some sense of responsibility for their behavior as well. We're to offer practical direction and techniques, homework, and applied skills when they're appropriate. One of the things we need to be very clear about is that we're not just this expert. A lot of times clients come into us thinking we have the magic answer, that we're the expert. They may even call us falsely doctor. They may call us certain titles. They may think of us as this guru that's just going to spit out advice at them. But it's important for us to reframe our role as a helper, a facilitator, a therapeutic partner with them. It's also important that we let them know that we are one of many resources that they can use, that we are to be used in connection with community resources, connection with their social support systems, and other options out there. We need to keep in mind that the issues that the client may think are important may not always be things that we think are important, but it's important nonetheless to not delay in addressing the issues that are important for the client. The more we can address things in a timely manner, the more we can reduce potential discord, potential tension, potential risk factors. We should remain calm and attentive in times of emergencies. And it's important to have policies in place for what happens when things do become an emergency. What do we do? Who do we contact? Are there crisis agencies in the area of where you live that you can refer to? Share the last resorts and options when needed as well with the client. One of the models that I really like in terms of ethical evaluation is called the four quadrant approach of Foster and Black. They look at these four quadrants all combining to make a good ethical decision. So typically what we think of as ethics is what they consider quadrant one, ethics and justice. What are the standards of the board? What are the standards of the ethics committee? What are the basic principles of counselor and client interaction? What sort of education is expected of us? Supervision, training, and accreditation. Secondly, we're looking at quadrant two called legalities. Now, this is the area we might be weak in. Honestly, most of us tend to not know what has happened in terms of precedents, civilly or criminally. Apart from the big things, like the dual relationships and such, we don't always know what's happened before in terms of cases. So that's where it's useful to have someone to be able to consult with who understands mental health legalities. The thing that you might want to check on if you're not aware of is finding out if your liability insurance company covers some type of defense reimbursement and consultation with an attorney. I know my plan has that coverage, and many times they do. Oftentimes, if you have that sense of hesitancy that I talked about or not sure about how to deal with the situation, if you call your liability insurance company, they'll put someone on the phone to be able to talk with you and advise you. I remember in a situation I had where I wasn't sure the best course of action with a borderline who was just very demanding of time and kept insisting that I do certain things that I didn't feel were right. I called my liability insurance company, and the gentleman who had a background in mental health law reminded me of something important. He said, just because this borderline client signs a million releases and asks that you talk with all these people doesn't mean that anything can force you to follow up on those releases. You have to consider whether it's the best interest of the client or not. And nothing can force you to follow up on all those releases. Quadrant 3, in terms of this four-quadrant approach, has to do with personal variables. How the counselor himself or herself deals with stress. How do we maintain our own well-being? How are we balanced? How do we not take on the client's issues as our own? Have we gone to therapy, for example, if we need to go to therapy for something? Because what happens is sometimes we're at risk for what's called vicarious traumatization if we don't deal with our own issues. And finally, the fourth quadrant has to do with morals, our sense of values and beliefs, what is right for the counselor. So we're looking at making sure we maintain relational connection with supervisors and colleagues. We're looking at the degree to which we do or do not function independently. This is one of the keys I really want you to pause and consider when you're making a decision. This is also where ethics comes into play. Sometimes you have a person acting too independently, not consulting with colleagues, not looking at what an appropriate standard of practice would be for a given situation or issue. That could set up for some unethical behaviors. So looking at the timing and the direction of counseling, looking at whether we're doing good or harm, looking at our competency areas. It's important when you have a choice to make sure that you are only voluntarily taking on the types of clients that are within your scope of practice. And if you're in a setting like a crisis-related setting or a hospital or community mental health where you pretty much are taking anyone that comes in and walks in, it's important to make sure where you have those deficits that you're making that known to colleagues, that you're consulting, that you're involving other people who professionally can help build that sense of competence. Humility is also important. It's important to know what you don't know. None of us is going to know everything or be able to deal with every type of client. So it's important to be aware of the areas we need to grow in and have willingness to reach out and develop those skills. Situations aren't always clear-cut. Just like I read that quote at the beginning of today's seminar, counseling situations are rather intricate, and so we need to be open to complexity and ambiguity, and we need to be self-aware. There are some key questions that, regardless of the type of ethical model, would be useful in terms of evaluating ethics. What factors am I aware of in this case? Are there areas I would need additional information in? There's nothing wrong, except in the area of like a crisis situation or a safety situation, with taking a pause and collecting your information and consulting with colleagues. Looking at what is the perspective of the board? Are there any policies which apply to this case? What are the contextual factors, the thoughts, the beliefs, values, or culture? How should I interact with this client? What is my role as counselor with this client? What are my internal perspectives on this case? And this has to go back to what I said of, do you have that sense of hesitancy or that red flag or that pause? What goals need to happen? Is there a treatment plan? I think one of the most useful things that creates a healthy pause for us when there may be ethical concerns is going back to the treatment plan. A treatment plan, like I said, should give specific, concrete, measurable, observable guidelines. We can look at any precedents that have been before. We can look at who we are professionally. Is there anything significant about the case? What do I need to do? Is this case really within my scope of practice? So ethical standards, while we have some differences of setting, of types of clients, of, just things to consider in terms of our decision making, ethical standards do give us some sense of specific guidance. It helps us keep our colleagues accountable. But most of all, the purpose of the ethical guidelines is to help the public know what the guidelines are. So let's look at some specific issues, and we're going to come up with some scenarios here to discuss. I want you to think of some of the models that we've already talked about and consider proactively ahead of time how you would handle these. First situation, you run into a former client out in public, quote, by accident. This was a gentleman you had counseled 7 years ago for grief counseling after his previous wife had passed. He shakes your hand and states that he still appreciates the support and sense of perspective you offered him through that dark time in his life. He initiates some conversation about relationships, and states that he could see that you would be a very caring and loving person in a relationship. Eventually, he asks if you're seeing anyone, and if you'd like to join him for dinner sometime, as you've not been in a therapeutic relationship with him for some time. How do you handle this? One of the things I want to very clearly say is anytime we're looking at what's the line between how long can I wait to have a personal relationship with this client or how close can I get? We're treading on some dangerous ground. I remember one attendee of one of my former seminars saying, well, aren't there other fish in the sea? Do you have to be best friends or be in a close relationship with that client or former client? So the positive thing here in this situation is that this was by accident. It wasn't like you and the client or former client actually arranged to meet together. And this does happen to all of us. We do from time to time run into former clients. But the concern here is that there was a bit of time that you and this gentleman were actually engaged in a conversation. Enough for the guy to say that you're caring and loving and, you know, maybe you could see each other if you weren't seeing someone else. That's where it's really important to maintain, even beyond when you're actively engaged in that therapeutic relationship in your office, that the function of therapist, the function of being in a therapeutic relationship is something that continues beyond the ongoing counseling. I wouldn't even answer the question about if you're seeing someone or what's happening in your personal life. I would redirect whether it was during the time when I was actively seeing a client or if it was years later. I would mention that my focus as a therapist is on the presenting concerns that person has brought to me. And likewise, my focus would always be on them clinically, as opposed to any personal sharing of what's going on within my life. Let's look at a second scenario here. One of your clients seems to be sitting particularly close to you these last few sessions. You start to feel uncomfortable, as if the client is invading your space bubble. Later on, when you're summarizing the session and giving homework, the client moves in even closer towards you and rubs your arm, stating that he or she doesn't know what he would do without you. You've been the closest person I've ever had. I've never known parents, partners, friends, or anyone who cared for me like you do. The client steps closer towards you, and again with very intense eye contact states, "I mean it. You've been the world to me, and the way you reassure me is a connection I've never felt with someone. You're my angel." So first of all, we need to be careful at not being taken in by a client's compliment or flattery. We need to keep on a very behavioral level with a client. On the one hand, there's probably a lot of truth in what this client's saying. They may not have had support systems in their life that have attended to, listened, or empathized with them the way you have. But that's why one of our tasks as a therapist of helping connect them to support systems is key. Because we don't want to create dependency. We shouldn't be, in the long run, their primary support system. We need to help connect them to community resources. If there are family or friends available, if there's support groups out there, any other supports that may be able to be there for them. We also need to be careful at communicating with the client that we're really taking to heart this personal compliment, that you're the angel, that you're the closest person they've ever had. Because as soon as you start responding to that flattery, and as soon as you start realizing that it's really getting to you, that's where the client can really play on that. That's where, even if you don't need, per se, ongoing supervision because you're independently licensed, it's important to still have that. Because what the supervision will offer you is someone to check in with you about situations like this. Let's look at another situation. A client who is rather manic and has been off her medications begins exhibiting very sexualized behaviors. She flashes body parts and tries disrobing. You're just trying to do your paperwork for treatment planning with her when this happens, as the new treatment plan is coming due. How do you handle this? So, first of all, I can't say enough that we need to reiterate as many different ways as possible what the ethical guidelines are and the policies and procedures for our therapy. They need to be initially in writing in terms of our written policies and procedures that are signed as we enter into the therapeutic relationship. They need to be reiterated verbally, and they need to be reiterated over and over when there are situations that arise like this. I remember I had a colleague when I worked down in Cincinnati who said that a situation similar to this happened. He was in the middle of counseling and working with a woman, and she started disrobing. Very matter of fact, he went back to the standards and the boundaries and policies and said, "I hear that you're wanting to deal with such and such. At this time, we're going to have to pause the session. I'm not able to continue while you're, taking your clothes off. I'm going to be stepping out into the waiting room area. And when you're ready to continue our session with your clothes on and focusing on the therapeutic plan that we're talking about, come to the waiting area and let me know. But until then, we're going to have to pause because I'm not going to create an unethical situation, and I'm not going to allow any question about the professional nature of our clinical relationship. It's also important to make sure in the setting you're in that as much as possible that you're not alone with clients. Just because a client who might be more histrionic, might be more flirtatious, can say certain things, but when you're in a setting like a shared practice and there's someone else around, like that gentleman, the counselor, went to the waiting room area, we could see him out there. We could check in with him and be like, hey, what's going on? And for him to be able to say, well, my client is doing A, B, and C. Let's look at another scenario. A gentleman arrives before his wife for their scheduled marriage counseling session. The wife calls and states she's on her way, just a few minutes behind at a traffic light. The husband begins joking with you about relationship matters and telling you some jokes about males versus females. How do you respond? So it's important when we're dealing with couples to state up front what the boundaries are. If the marriage and the couple is the client, what happens if one comes earlier than the other? Will you start to see him or her? What happens if one can't make the session? Will you do individual therapy with the other? How does confidentiality work? So one of the things that might have been important in this session is that beforehand that you were clear with the husband and wife about waiting until each of them was present to do the session. Also, I would not respond to these jokes that he's giving. They may be funny. They may be something that, on a personal level you wish you could respond to. But the fact is, it's important to go back to what's my role in this situation. What am I supposed to be doing in terms of the presenting concern and the treatment plan? What about a client of the opposite sex winks at you and comments, "You look so nice in that color. You should wear it more often." How do you respond? Again, a lot of times when our clients are saying stuff, it's not always totally manipulative. We may think sometimes it is, and some of our clients can be manipulative, but there are some times where they're just giving a compliment. I would be careful, regardless of which situation it is, to make it clear that you're not going to feed into that compliment type of thing, that it's not getting to you so much, that they're not, quote unquote, having an unfair advantage, that they're not maybe stating a compliment to gain ground that was lost in the session. So I would get back again to the treatment plan, the presenting concern. I would not stay too long on the issue. Depending on gauging what the motive of that client is, I might acknowledge a compliment, but then move on and say, let's get back to the treatment plan. Let's get back to today's agenda here. Let's look at the next scenario. Martha, a 90-year-old woman, cries incessantly. "He, my husband who passed on, was the only boy I've ever held hands with, and we spent nearly every day together. It's not the same without him. She then asks if she can have a hug. Do you hug her? Remember I said earlier, the context, the presenting concern, the type of agency you're working for, all makes a difference. So this is a 90-year-old woman. Sounds like she's going through some real grief. Sounds like there might even be some harm if we don't hug her, that it might be seen as cold and unempathic. So maybe giving her a professional hug might be important. Now, would the situation be any different if this was a young, attractive 25-year-old female who just lost someone? Could you pat her on the hand? Could you give a side hug? You see how just the age of the person, the situation, the context can make a little bit of a difference. What about if the person is someone with HIV who says that everyone has left him and his partner of 20 years left when he found out about his diagnosis? Do you hug that client? So regardless of the HIV, this is a grieving person. Regardless of the situation, is your policy going to be that when someone's dealing with grief, for the most part, as long as it's a healthy professional hug, that you're going to allow for a reassuring hug when someone's going through grief? Finally, what about if it's a client who's been through a great deal of physical or sexual trauma? Now, with clients who I'm aware have been through trauma, I tend to ask them about how close or how far away I sit. If I have to, for example, show them paperwork, I might say, I'm going to move my chair a couple feet closer. Is that okay with you? Just so we can see the paperwork and go over this. You know, someone who's been through a great deal of physical and sexual trauma, I also want to be cautious about if they're asking for a hug, what that might mean to them. There's symbolic value in gestures like a hug or gift giving that we'll talk about after a while. They mean something to a client, and that's where we need to gauge what does this mean to the client and where do the professional boundaries fit in. Let's look at this last example in terms of sex or relationships with clients. A handsome, narcissistic young man comments in a session, I know what people want in relationships. Like if I wanted to get with you right now, even if it wasn't on your mind, before long, we'd be in a relationship. People know, they just don't turn me down. How do you respond? I remember having a similar situation like this with one of my past clients. And that's when I started making sure that more clinicians were in the office during that time. I started making sure that he saw the activity of other people around the office. I started really being even more purposeful in terms of our therapeutic relationship. In terms of responding to the comment about if I wanted to get with you, I depersonalized the comment and talked about it in the context of, so it sounds like your pattern has been that when you want something, you basically let the other person know what you want and there's no choice for them, that they go ahead with it. And when I made it more general, more broad, he said, yeah, that's right. That's right. The women I've dated, this person, that person, all these different settings, I've approached it that way. So that way I'm still dealing therapeutically with this behavior that this narcissistic and antisocial gentleman has of, you know, I'll tell you what relationship you're going to be in with me and you have to respond. In terms of sex or intimacy or relationships with clients, there should be no sexual relationship allowed. When we're talking about any type of relationship, kissing, sexual intercourse, fondling, physical advances, even anything that could be perceived by a client as an advance. We're talking about the way we dress. We're talking about what we joke about. Keep in mind, as I said before, that there is a power differential. And this is someone coming to us because of presenting concerns. A therapist who's choosing to engage in a sexual relationship with a current or former client is effectively choosing to discard his or her career. So when we're talking about touch, it's not that necessarily touch in and of itself is always wrong. For example, in the case of grief, reassuring a client, a pat on the shoulder, an ailing person, a person who just found out a diagnosis. So we have to look at, could doing this touch be beneficial or harmful? Could not reassuring the patient be beneficial or harmful? What if someone's crying and just found out a medical diagnosis and I fold my hands and look away from them? That could actually be more harmful. The use of touch in counseling may need to be an early part of discussion on policies and procedures. For example, if the work that you're doing is grief work, that should be addressed up front in terms of physical interactions. There's no ethical codes which specifically prohibit general comfort touching or hugs, like a tap on the shoulder, patting someone's hand, a side hug. But having said this, I want to make sure you understand that touch in of itself isn't necessarily unethical when it's a reasonable touch, a non-sexual touch. But touch is a precursor to boundary crossings. When there have been unhealthy dual relationships, especially of a sexual nature, touch at some level was a precursor to that dual relationship. The questions we need to consider are things, is there potential for harm? Is it comforting and consistent with the process variables of a healthy therapeutic relationship? Would it be perceived as non-empathic if I did not offer some type of comforting touch? What's the client's perception, and is there full informed consent? Now we're going to look at a few scenarios regarding the issue of continuing ed. You really like working with children. You seem to be able to relate to them well. Recently, you've begun marketing to referral sources that you are, quote, a child specialist, since you know you'd like to work with this population. You also add child and adolescent counseling on your disclosure statement to be posted on the wall of your office. Sure, you haven't really taken any CEUs in child counseling techniques, and your actual history of counseling children and families has been extremely limited, but you feel this would be a good fit for you. You've done well babysitting and nannying in the past, so you're sure that you'd be good at child therapy. Is there anything wrong with considering this part of your scope of practice? So just because we like a certain population or think we'd be good at it doesn't necessarily mean it's technically part of our scope of practice. There should be education and experience that's commensurate with that. I know some of the insurance panels I'm on actually have asked in the past for copies of continuing education certificates, or have asked about what percentage of your population is, say, children, or whatever the group is that I'm saying that I'm able to work with. It's dangerous to say that you're, quote-unquote, a specialist in any area. Even if I was someone, for example, who had half my caseload or 75% of my caseload be children and families, I would always avoid the word specialist. Specialist is a dangerous word and a word that the board also hopes that we would not use, because the word specialist gives an unfair advantage and makes it sound to the public like we're somehow better in working with this population than the person down the street is. If you actually have the CEUs and the experience in working with children and adolescents, I would say I offer child and adolescent counseling. I would list that on your disclosure statement. I might list that on the marketing. But I would not use the word specialist. Specialist is something that I would say is a bit of a red flag, because, again, it gives an unfair advantage. When we talk about marketing and advertising, just the use of the word specialist makes that person think that you're higher up than the other person that deals with children and adolescents. It would be like me saying I'm a depression specialist. There's really nothing like that, a depression specialist. All of us who've dealt with diagnosis and treatment of mental health disorders are aware of ways to treat depression, but just the use of the word specialist would be a red flag, even if I had the education to support that that's one of my scopes of practice. Let's look at the next scenario here. You know you're supposed to get 30 CEUs in 2 years, but life got busy on you, and you did not realize prior to the time of the renewal that you only had 20 CEUs taken so far. You sign anyway that you're up to date, and you pay your fee, figuring you'll catch up soon. Is this okay? Keep in mind, any of our responsibilities as a therapist and ethically are supposed to be things that we follow up on. It's our responsibility to get those 30 CEUs in 2 years. Yeah, life can get busy. I have known of colleagues that had difficulty catching up with their CEUs. But the fact of the matter is, if you know that that's a struggle for you, it's important to find ways to get those in. I remember one colleague of ours, what she would do is she would take a few days off of work and focus just on her continuing education. That way she didn't have something else going on at the same time, and she knew she was devoting time to that. This is important because sometimes you don't realize the potential side effects of not having your CEUs. One, it's a requirement for your licensure, so it's not questionable. Secondly, if you're on insurance panels, you may have consequences if you don't have your continuing education up to date. One of our colleagues that I used to work with in terms of her practice, she thought she had all her continuing ed and signed off that she did and found out that she was a few hours short. When the insurance company, one of them, got wind of it, they wanted her to turn in all the back payments for a certain time period. So she had some major consequences as a result of that. Let's look at the next one here, the next scenario. You thought a program was pre-approved, but when you arrive for the seminar, you find out that it's not pre-approved by the Counseling, Social Worker, and Marriage Family Therapist Board. Your license expires in 1 week, so you don't have much time left. How do you handle this? So what I would do is I would make sure and follow the procedure for the post-program approval. If you're not sure ahead of time, first of all, I would make sure, well, anytime I sign up for a CEU, that it's something that is pre-approved. Or if it's something that you're not sure if it will be approved, it's really important to do that post-program approval as soon as possible. I wouldn't take a course within 1 week of my mandated renewal, because it doesn't give enough time to be sure that the board will approve it. Now, I've had people from other states that have taken some of my continuing ed courses. I've had people that had multiple or dual licensure, and sometimes there's extra requirements they have. I know one gentleman is licensed in a few states, and he'll have me print out the course description, the schedule, various things to be able to submit to the other state, and they end up granting him credit for the CEU for my courses, even though I'm not licensed or a provider of CEUs in that state. Let's look at the next scenario here. You've decided to be a stay-at-home mom for a few years since the recent birth of your child. Your license is an inactive status. When you run into someone in the community, they ask you what you do for a living. You say you're a licensed professional clinical counselor. What's wrong with this? So in Ohio, we do have the opportunity for people to put their license in inactive status. That means during that time, they're not able to do the diagnosis and treatment of mental health disorders. Someone like a stay-at-home mom, someone who maybe is taking time off for self-care, or maybe they had a health issue. Those might be examples of someone who puts their license in inactive status. During the time of inactive status, the person may not need to do their continuing education, but as soon as they want the license to be active again, they must meet the board requirement to be in active status. So, for example, this person, even though she may have in the past had the licensed professional clinical counselor designation, during the time that her license is not active, she cannot call herself that. Let's look at the next scenario. Mr. Walters says that since he teaches continuing education and writes articles on doing therapy, he doesn't have to get any outside CEUs anymore. This is correct. So the board does at times grant part or full credit for continuing education, but those things need to be submitted to the board. Again, the board is the one who ultimately determines if a course was pre-approved, if teaching or writing a book is meeting the standard for the credits. So he should not assume that it is. I know when I've taught seminars, that's something that I've submitted and gotten some credit for, actually teaching seminars. Getting and maintaining CEUs. Again, the standard is at least 30 hours in a 2-year period, 3 or more in ethics or multicultural competency, 3 or more in supervision if you have that designation. Now, they've recently changed the rule about counselors having to get their CEUs in person. Until relatively recently, for licensed professional counselors, we had to get at least half of ours in person. But that has been changed. So be very clear that now you have the option of doing all your 30 CEUs either as home study or some portion of them as home study and some portion in person. But it doesn't have to be at least half of them in person. A number of people will be audited in terms of their CEUs. It's important to provide our records of any types of things that you've attended in a timely manner. Keep your certificates and documentation. The fact of the matter is, if you do not pass your audit, you will face fines and fees. Hopefully, all of you are aware of the current CE broker system. If you're not, it's an online system. I would encourage you to go to CE Broker, register an account. Because what it does is once you're registered and put your name and your licensure in there, it enables you to scan to the CE broker system, which will go directly to the State of Ohio Counselor, Social Worker, and Marriage and Family Therapist Board, your CEU certificates. Then after you scan those, within a matter of days, you usually get something back from the board saying about which portion, if not all, of the continuing education course that you went to or that you did online has been approved. So it'll actually track for you. Like for me, it'll say you've reached this percentage of the total. This is counted, it's counted towards ethics. This is counted towards your total. And it's kind of neat because you get to see a graph of it. So in terms of education, what would you do if a friend of yours says that he or she, quote, is heading a counseling outreach at a local church? The friend has not obtained a degree in a counseling field, but has a heart for hurting people and has received some paraprofessional training in, quote, emotional healing. What should your reaction be? Do you agree that this friend is doing counseling? Now, in the state of Ohio, counseling, the use of the word counseling means someone who is a licensed professional counselor, a licensed professional clinical counselor, or a supervising counselor, someone who has received the education, it's been accredited, they pass a licensure test, and the board has given them an okay that says, yes, you are licensed as a counselor. The only exception to this would be people who are pastoral, like a licensed ordained minister under a church. So that's something that this person would need to check into. Just because someone's taken some helping courses doesn't necessarily mean they have the designation as counselor. Let's look at the standard on education. People should not promote a degree from a school that's not accredited. And the code says no person may claim either orally or in writing that they possess an academic degree or a title associated with said degree unless the person has in fact been awarded a degree from an institution that is accredited by a regional or professional accrediting agency recognized by the United States Department of Education at the Commission on Recognition of Post-Secondary Accreditation. Now let's turn to this issue of diagnosis. Let's look at our first scenario. You work in an inpatient hospital. A potential client comes in looking disheveled, with body odor and poor ADLs. He seems to be staring a lot and is not particularly communicative in your assessment. Your colleague states, well, he's obviously schizophrenic. He's not taking care of himself, has poor social skills, and must be attending to internal stimuli. What's your response? So first of all, we need to be aware that diagnosis isn't based on our feeling about a person. Just because someone looks a certain way, or we feel a certain way around them, doesn't necessarily substantiate a diagnosis. Just because we think someone's disheveled or has body odor may or may not mean that they're schizophrenic, may or may not mean that they're depressed. Something might have spilled on them and they didn't get a chance to clean it up. We have to look at what facts and information we actually have. Do we have collateral that shows that the person has had a history of schizophrenia and that that might be what's going on now? Are they actually attending to stimuli? Or is there a reason they appear to be, quote, staring into space? We have to make sure that our diagnosis is based on facts and that it lines up with the ICD and the DSM. Let's look at the next scenario. Your supervisee mentioned that a child client is having symptoms of difficulty concentrating, restlessness, and decreased school performance. He states that based on these, he's diagnosed ADHD. If you are the supervisor, what is your response? Do you agree? Again, we have to look at what the DSM criteria are and what the ICD criteria are. One of the things that would be important to focus on is not isolating just specific symptoms. It could be easy to look at specific symptoms and say, oh, that person tends to be spaced out. They must have ADD. Who knows? They might be grieving a loss. They might be depressed. There might be something else going on that they're thinking of. So we would need to look at, do they meet the cluster of symptoms and do they meet the time requirement and enough of the symptoms to say that it's this diagnosis? Would your response in the situation change if you found out the child is new to the school and nervous? Keep that in mind. Maybe it's not so much ADHD, but it's a new situation that's hard for anyone. And they're nervous, so they're spacing out. They're afraid of making new friends. They're not sure how to approach the teacher in the school. What about would your response change if they had limited English speaking skills? That could make a big difference. Would your response change if you found out the grandparent who raised the child just died last week? You see, it's important to get collateral and get this information because it really can make a difference. How might these different factors affect diagnosis? The more different pieces we can look at in terms of psychosocial assessment, the more full data we have to make an accurate diagnosis. We have to look at the context and system and the cluster of different diagnostic symptoms. Let's look at this next one. You overhear a client talking to another colleague. You overheard a colleague talking to another colleague about a client. With that mood and drama, she has to be borderline. What's your take on that? Is that correct? Is there any other possibility? I can't tell you how many times someone has used the word borderline or misused the word just to describe a client that they felt was a difficult person. The fact of the matter is borderline doesn't necessarily mean difficult. Borderline has a whole description of a host of symptoms that go with it. And just like any other disorder, the person needs to meet the time requirement, needs to meet the symptoms, and needs to go according to the facts in the situation. Not just opinion, not just my feeling. So I definitely would talk with a colleague about, okay, let's get out the DSM. Let's see what the quality is. Is this a pervasive behavior? Has this been going on for years? Is it the affect instability? Are there safety issues? Do they seem to have superficial relationships? Go through each of the symptoms. Is there any other possibility? Is there a reason someone might be quote-unquote moody or seem dramatic? There's times I think many people can be moody or dramatic and may or may not even have a diagnosis. Let's look at this next scenario. A client is convinced that his relatives are poisoning his food and cursing it. He comes from a culture where voodoo and curses are common. Should you go ahead and diagnose him with a psychotic disorder, as some colleagues suggest, or not? Well, I actually had someone who met this situation, and his relatives did have access to his apartment. They had keys, and they were angry because he was quote-unquote doing well in America, and they were not doing as well from the country that he came from. They were cursing in words and in spells his food, his house, and so he felt like he couldn't eat because they cursed his food. Now, I asked him, I said, what would it be like if you didn't allow them access to your house? Is it possible, since you know, they have access to your house, is it possible to get the key from them? Is it possible to limit this so that you're able to eat healthy? And so, on the one hand, we were respecting his culture. Even if I don't necessarily do things the same way he does, it's important to understand the narrative behind what our client's going through. And so even on his assessment, I wrote down the known cultural variables for the doctor to take into consideration. Let's look at this next scenario in terms of diagnosis. When assessing a new client, you discover he has numerous life stressors he has had to adjust to in the last 6 months. His frustration tolerance has been low, and he exhibits some depression and anxiety symptoms. While it seems like more of an adjustment disorder with mood and behavioral symptoms, you're made aware that his insurance will not pay unless you diagnose major depression. How do you handle this? So I would have a discussion with the client. Oftentimes, I've even seen on people's policies and procedures a statement about insurance, that your insurance is a method for reimbursement, it's not a replacement for payment, and then let them know that with insurance, there needs to be a diagnosis, that there's no guarantee that definitely based on that diagnosis, that the insurance always will pay. So those are some things that you may need to discuss ahead of time. I've had some clients that have chosen not to use their insurance and to pay out of pocket instead because they either didn't want their diagnosis on record or they weren't sure that the insurance would cover certain things. And I have had scenarios. I remember years ago, I had someone that it was after many months working with them that Anthem said they wouldn't cover an adjustment disorder diagnosis. And I didn't want to be unethical or magnify symptoms that really didn't meet criteria for something. So it's really important to have those discussions. So in terms of diagnosis, it's unethical for the therapist to be acting as a moral agent. We're not supposed to subjectively make decisions about just because someone or being around a certain person feels a certain way or just because of limited information that they have a certain issue. We're supposed to look at the whole symptom cluster, like I said, based on observation of concrete, observable types of symptoms. We're supposed to do our diagnosis with respect to client perspectives and worldview, and with full information and informed consent. Our diagnosis should also occur under a specific contract outlining the terms of our therapeutic relationship. Again, the more you can spell out in terms of your policies and procedures up front and then reiterate it as needed throughout the course of the therapeutic relationships, the better you'll be. In terms of licensure, the main thing I want to say is that in Ohio, they will consider people that have been in other states, states or other countries, depending on what their education is, what the accreditation is, whether they've passed or not passed their licensure, and what their experience is. So if a colleague were to ask you if so-and-so could possibly become an LPCC in Ohio, that they had worked in another state, I always direct them to talk directly to the board, because the board will have their own ideas on what is or is not covered. It's really important for people to submit directly to the board their transcripts of all their college, of all their experience. And some states do have reciprocity with each other, so that's something to consider as well. Let's look at some scenarios regarding supervision now. A supervisee has excellent clinical skills with clients. However, it's apparent that his self-care is greatly lacking. For example, he's often rushed and backed up due to the impact of his personal life stresses, to where his scheduled sessions oftentimes start 10 to 20 minutes late. He arrives to work flustered due to issues at home and is a bit disheveled. On the other hand, once he starts talking with clients, he's attentive, he uses evidence-based techniques, and demonstrates high efficacy in his outcomes. Is there anything that needs to be addressed here? So, one of the things we have to keep in mind is just because someone's clinically good during their interactions with a client, there's a lot of other variables that being an effective clinician entails. Things like arriving on time. When we put in our policies and procedures and highlight with clients the importance of them arriving on time, it's important to be timely ourselves. I've even known at one agency that I worked at, they had in their policies and procedures that if they were more than so many minutes late and there was an emergency, what they would do. That it was a rare occurrence, but that sometimes some of the clients in private practice turned into an emergency. And so they had a policy about how that would be handled and people would be rescheduled or what would happen. It's important to have things in terms of policies, but it's important also that we behave as professionals ourselves. Let's look at the next scenario regarding supervision. A certain issue has been brought up to a supervisee multiple times. However, the ethical concern continues, with the supervisee minimizing his ethical risk. How should this be handled? So, one of the things that people need to realize is that just like we keep notes for our interactions with our clients, it is important for supervisors to keep notes in terms of their interactions with their supervisee. There's a lot of different reasons for keeping these notes, but one, to look at what happens in the supervision session, to also look at what advice is given in terms of arriving on time, professionalism, and whatever issues have already been confronted. That way, the supervisor can say, oh, it's been five different times that I've brought up such and such issue to the supervisee. We talked about this plan of intervention and such behavior still happening. Then they can go back from there. Let's look at the next scenario here. You've noticed the supervisee giving certain more favorable cooperative clients extra time for their sessions to where they've been getting 60-minute sessions. On the other hand, that same supervisee has been quick to wrap up her sessions with other quote-unquote tough clients in the allotted 45 minutes. How do you handle this? That would be something I would definitely bring up, because sessions should be consistent across the board. If the amount of time for scheduled sessions, for example, is 45 to 50 minutes, and we're using a CPT billing code for that amount of time, then that's what the person should be getting. If an emergency comes up and more time is needed, that's one situation where you would consult with the client, the insurance company, see about getting that extra time. But if it's a matter of unfairly giving more time to the clients you like versus the clients you don't like as much, then there's an ethical issue there. That's something to keep in mind. I've known some people, I don't do this myself, but I've known some therapists who actually had a timer in their session, and there'd be a beep or a warning or something when there was maybe 10 minutes to go, so they would start doing a summary, start looking at homework assignments for the next session, and start wrapping up. So that way there was a tangible way that the client realized that, you know, we're starting to wrap up, we're not going to be looking at new issues. So we're looking at the roles and scope of practice being outlined and delineated in terms of what the supervisor's responsibilities are, what the supervisee's responsibilities are, the start and end dates being delineated, that supervisor should be practicing only in their areas of competence, should not be supervising family members or relatives, and any time a supervisee is documenting something, the supervisor should also be signing off on it. Any reports, any letters need to be also signed. The supervisee needs to openly acknowledge the relationship of having a supervisor. So, like in my practice, I will have supervisees actually have a bio where it will say, so-and-so is my supervisor, I'm attending school, this is where I'm at in terms of the process of going towards my independent licensure. Any filing of things with the boards or school is a supervisee's responsibility. And if there are changes in the supervision agreement, there needs to be at least a 30-day warning to the board, a 30-day notice to them so that the board can get back and give an approval or a denial. One of the things that I've learned in terms of having a variety of, in the past, different kinds of supervisees, is that it's really important to go through an interview with potential supervisees just like someone would for a job interview. What are their goals and expectations? Do they really fit in with the company or the position that you're looking for? What are their goals as a clinician? What goals do they have in terms of supervision? What do they feel is effective supervision? Are there certain styles of supervision that would work better with them or not as good? What have their experiences been to this point? Are there any special populations or different theoretical orientations that they prefer? Or anything that is not good? When we're talking about boundaries of supervisees, keep in mind that there is a power differential. That supervisee is being evaluated. So even though we're not talking about a client and a counselor, there is a difference in terms of where they're at. And we have to take that into consideration. We need to make sure that there's not an ability for exploitation, that there should never be a dual relationship going on. If there's any type of things being written, like research or books, a lot of times supervisees often don't get given the real credit for all the work they do. So it's important ethically to make sure that the role of the supervisee in that is adequately listed. There needs to be honest credit or citation to sources. Honest evaluation of the board. Now, I know many of my colleagues, if they've been a supervisee long enough, had one or more not so good cases as supervisees. Some that have really been tough for them to deal with. And if and when this happens, it's still important to make sure that our evaluation to the board is honest. It should be specific. It should be based on specific measurable interactions. And that's where that documentation of the notes of what happens in supervision is really, really important, because that can go pretty far in saying, oh, wow, these are the things that have been discussed to this point. This is what has been recommended, and how the supervisees responded or not responded to it. Supervision should also be a two-way interaction. We should talk with supervisees about how they would bring up concerns. There needs to be a way that the supervisor is approachable. Other considerations that need to occur in terms of supervision are making sure that the supervisor realizes the vicarious responsibility that they have for what the supervisee does. Issues about making sure that any clients that are involved in the mix are aware of the supervision relationship, that dual relationships are avoided, that both the supervisee and the supervisor only deal in competency areas, and that client issues and supervision issues are under the boundary of confidentiality. So as we wrap up this first section, I just wanted to review a few quick things here. We talked about a few different areas, and we came at things with the idea that while there are professional codes of ethics that we need to be aware of, that there is a context that they occur in, they're always a work in progress, they're developed by committees, examined by professionals and the public they serve. And that a lot of times, even though we say our professions, counseling, social work, and marriage and family therapists are different, that there is some overlap in terms of what we do. We talked about a number of different ethical decision-making approaches. And my hope is that in giving you these different decision-making considerations and approaches, that you will approach situations in a proactive manner, that you will consult with colleagues, that you will build a standard of practice, that you won't wait until you feel like things are on a bad footing potentially with a client or that there might be something unethical, but that you proactively learn and note what the ethical standards of our professions are, that you'll keep up with what the board is deciding, that you'll consult with colleagues, that when you have that sense of uneasiness, that you're not sure if you're making a right decision or what you should do at a certain point, that you will pause, that you will consult, whether it's with the board, with the ethical standards, with other people, or even calling your liability insurance company. So as we wrap up this first session, we looked at things like sexual boundaries and relationship boundaries. I highlighted the fact that once a patient's a client, even if it's for a one-time evaluation, there's always considered some type of therapeutic relationship or connection, and we should act as such, even though time may have passed. When we're looking at education, we also should not misrepresent ourselves, but we should make sure we have the education and the competency that's commensurate with what we're saying is our scope of practice. We also looked at diagnosis, and with diagnosis, we highlighted the importance of making sure that diagnosis is backed up in terms of specific, concrete, measurable types of things that are in the DSM, not just isolated variables or symptoms. We talked about how the board may consider people for licensure from different areas depending on what criteria they meet. And we also looked at supervision. Supervision, we talked about, should also address boundaries because there is a power differential. And prior to that, forgot to add in here, we also talked about diagnosis and making sure that diagnosis is specific to the individual, that it's not just based on feelings or subjective experience, but that it's based on DSM criteria and concrete behavioral types of factors there. So when we pick up this next section, we're going to continue and we're going to look at the issue of competency. Thank you for joining me for this first section, and we'll continue shortly on our second part of today's seminar.